Okay, welcome again to Gita Wisdom. And can I just say how wonderful it is to see you guys? I kind of wait all week. I really do. This is my payoff for being a good boy, as I get to come and spend time with you. This is the first of a three-part series on Mahabharata. And I brought some different editions of the Mahabharata for you to see. And if you want later, I can explain what these various editions are. Some of them were very poetic, some are very scholarly. Some, as we discussed with the comic edition of Bhagavad Gita, you've got a comics edition of the Mahabharata here. But here's where we're starting. The basic philosophy in the Vedic texts is that we're not the bodies or minds, egos that kind of carry us around. I call it the latte syndrome. You know, you get up in the morning, your feet at the ground, you grab your latte and you're off and running. And whatever the image, the impression is that you've had about who you are, you're back into that from the day before. You know, I'm back into, this is my career, this is what I do, this is my list of to-dos here. The Vedic culture says stop, just stop, slow down. Yoga, breathe. Go deeper into an understanding of your permanent self and move through the day from that starting place and see what difference that might make. That's the basic it. That's it in a nutshell. You know, you're not the body, you're an eternal being. You're the consciousness within the body. What is that consciousness? It's a spark of God, of Krishna, the Supreme Person. We have all of Krishna's qualities in minute quantity, the way a spark of a fire has the same qualities as the fire, but in small proportion. So the soul is a spark of God with the eternity, the full self-awareness, and the joyful nature that God himself possesses. We've forgotten that, so we're in this problematic environment. You know, the world's a sad place. You know, and if you identify with it, you get sad. So the whole Vedic culture was about identify with your true self. Now, that message, to get that message across, it happened in many ways, because it's a big world, there's all kinds of people, not everybody's going to be into philosophy. Right? So through art, through the ritual, we hear the bells in the arti in the next room, through ritual, through dance and music and stories. And so that's what the Mahabharata does. The Mahabharata, one of the most beloved stories in all of human history, also the longest. It's 100,000 shlokas, or poetic verses. 100,000, that's longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined. It's 15 times the length of the Bible, just to kind of put it in some perspective for you. And it is the most beloved story in all of India. Now, how beloved is it, you might ask? I'm glad you asked. It's so beloved that when the series, there was a televised series in India, was broadcast, the entire nation came to a standstill. This is back in the 80s. And literally, businesses shut down for some bizarre reason. Doordarshan television scheduled it in the middle of the day. Why in the middle? The whole country came to a stop. And there were vociferous protests in the street for the producers to make even more episodes. There were already 120 odd episodes, and they wanted more. So just to give you an idea of how popular it is in India. Now, you were asking about the name. The name Mahabharata refers to Maha is great, like a Maharaja, you know, the great king. And Bharata was the name of a king in ancient Vedic times. But the word Bharata also refers to the world, all of humanity, because Bharat's kingdom was not limited to what we today call India. It was the entire globe. So Mahabharata, in a sense, means the greater history of humanity. Right? And there are stories within stories within stories within stories. Some of those stories within stories in these 100,000 verses run to 50 pages. So it's my teacher, for example, learned the Mahabharata from his grandmother. You know, it was Every night you can have a new dimension, a new page, a new story from within this epic tale. There were some translations of this ancient Sanskrit text that made their way into Europe first in the 18th century, late 18th century, then 19th century. But in the West, perhaps the most important popularization of the Mahabharata came as a result of a collaboration between these two extraordinary artists. Peter Brook is one of the great directors of our time. He's 89 now. But going back to the 1950s, originally his theories of theater were influenced by the experimental work of Jerzy Grotowski and Bertolt Brecht. And in the 1950s, Brook was director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. And then he moved into film, including films like Lord of the Flies in 1963, Murat Dasad in 1967, Meetings with Remarkable Men, which is about Gurdjieff, that was 1979, that was released, and others. Jean-Claude Carrière, about the same age as Peter, has written something like 40 books and screenplays. He's a marvelous screenwriter. The Tin Drum from 1979, Danton from 1983, Return of Martin Geyer from around that same time, The Unbearable Lightness of Being with Daniel Day-Lewis. When I first met them, it was here in Peter Brook's theater, Bouffe du Nord, in the north end of Paris. And as you can see, it's a very informal, you know, the walls are kind of chipped brick. And the Brooklyn Academy of Music modeled their renovation, if you will, based on Peter Brook's architecture in Bouffe du Nord. The renovation is kind of like, it looked more unfinished after they were done than before they started. But to give it that kind of raw feeling of an encounter. Here's another image of a performance. This is from the Mahabharata in French that took place in Bouffe du Nord in 1987, and then it came to America in 1989. Now, here's how it happened. Around 1970, a Sanskritist named Philippe Lavastine met Peter Brook and Jean-Claude Carrière and started telling them stories from the Mahabharata. Lavastine
was this very tall man with this extraordinary deep voice like this, and he would, you know, he'd quote verses like that from Bhagavad Gita and so on. And they went on for 5 years until one night, or one morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning, on the Rue Saint-André-des-Arts, which is where Lavastine had his apartment, Brook and Carrière decided that they had to bring this story of Mahabharata to the stage. And they began reading books and comparing notes. And it was around that time that I met them. They came, I was president of the Paris Krishna Temple, and they came to the temple. And I saw them there, and they were there for the arati, just as the arati that's going on next door. They came to see the arati. I asked them, why are you here? You know? And they described how they wanted to bring Mahabharata to the stage. And they stayed for about 3 hours, and I gave them some of Prabhupada's books, and we talked about theater. And shortly thereafter, Peter Brook and Jean-Claude and their theatrical troupe, their ensemble, went to India, spent many months there as well, studying diligently. Krishna's role was ambiguous for Brook and Carrière. Sometimes in their studies of Mahabharata and the stories, they would see that Krishna would act very human, becoming surprised or distressed. And at other moments, he would act very mystically. For example, you'll see in the scene that we're going to screen this evening, becoming an unlimited length of sari for the Pandava's wife Draupadi when the bad guys in the story tried to strip her naked in public. Krishna incarnated as her sari. Creating an illusion that the sun was setting before the appointed hour in order to bewilder the enemy. And then, of course, in the text of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna revealing his universal form. So they weren't quite sure what to do with that dual personality of Krishna, sometimes divine, sometimes human. And so in discussion, what they told me was that they decided that it wasn't up to them to convey theological truths. That was not their goal. They said, those mysteries are closed to us. We're outsiders to that. So they said their aim was to achieve dramatic truth. Now, what did he mean by dramatic truth? Well, for Peter Brook, the theater is a sacred encounter on the stage between the players and the audience through the medium of a play. And what Brook strives for, his method, if you will, is silence. He tries to bring an audience to that place of, you might call it, sacred silence. Not the deadly silence of, oh, I'm sitting here watching a play. But that silence which is, I've forgotten that I'm watching a play. I'm a part of this. So that was the kind of visceral experience that Peter Brook has always tried to achieve in his work. And the impressing, the staging for their version of Mahabharata was quite impressive. It ran to 9 hours long, this production. Let me just read something to you. This is a book, the transcript of, it's the script from these 9 hours of productions. And there's one passage in the introduction I wanted to read to you. He says, we didn't pay a great deal of attention to the various comments that people gave us, however interesting they might be. As far as we were concerned, this immense poem, which flows with the majesty of a great river, carries an inexhaustible richness which defies all structure, thematic, historic, or psychological analysis. Doors are constantly opening which lead to other doors. It is impossible to hold the Mahabharata in the palm of your hand. Layers of ramifications, sometimes contradictory, follow upon one another and are interwoven without losing the central theme. That theme is a threat. We live in a time of destruction. Everything points in the same direction. Can this destruction be avoided? Now, that's a very insightful take on the message of Mahabharata. Remember that the conclusion was this great, great battle. So the idea being, will we decide for ourselves to succumb to the material energy around us, or can we find that spark of the divine within us that will somehow provide unexpected tools of reconciliation, of progress, of moving forward? We're going to see, and we'll decide for ourselves in a little while, how successful they were in conveying that on the stage. But first, I want us to become familiar with the story, which is an epic challenge. You'll have to pardon the pun there. But I'm going to try to convey to you 100,000 verses in the next 15 to 20 minutes, okay? So brace yourself, get comfortable, and you know, cheer me on, because we're going for the big one here. Okay, once, thousands of years ago, at the junction of two cosmic eras, Dvapara and Kali, there were three brothers. Dhritarashtra, the eldest brother, was born blind. His younger brothers were Pandu, who was unable to have children, and Vidura, a religious man who never married. Now, you're going to see different kinds of illustrations throughout this PowerPoint presentation, from a wide range, some live stage things, some photography, some art, so you'll see a whole wide range of visual representations. Dhritarashtra was the eldest, but because he was blind, his brother Pandu was made king. Now, Dhritarashtra married a woman named Gandhari, who was so compassionate toward her husband's situation that she blindfolded herself so that she could understand her husband's experience of life. Now, this is a photo from a British stage production. Gandhari is one of several very powerful women in the story of Mahabharata, including Kunti, who is the mother of the Pandava brothers, Arjuna and his four brothers, who are the good guys in this story, and Draupadi, their wife. Gandhari, through a story which is way too long to tell, gave birth to 100 sons. And the eldest son was named Duryodhana. And collectively, these 100 brothers, sons of the blind king Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, were known as the Kauravas, sort of the bad guys, if you will, in this epic. Now, because Pandu could not have children, his wife Kunti invoked a boon, a blessing that allowed her to conceive with any of the gods upon whom she would call. And she called upon Yama, the god of death and justice, and Yudhishthira, the eldest son, was born with blessings to be judicious, truthful in thought, word, and deed. She called upon Vayu, god of wind, and so Bhima was born, so strong that when he rolled out of his crib, he hit the earth and caused a minor earthquake. She called on Indra, chief of the gods, and so Arjuna was born, to be unmatched in wisdom and knowledge of weapons, and destined to bring great fame to his family. Pandu's second wife, Madri, called upon the twin gods known as the Ashwins, and she gave birth to the twins Nakula and Sahadeva. So these five brothers collectively are known as the Pandavas. Now, here we go. Pandu died young, so the eldest of his sons, Yudhishthira, was going to be the next king when he came of age. The sons of the older brother, Dhritarashtra, blind Dhritarashtra, were furious. After all, if their father had not been born congenitally blind, they would inherit the throne. So they hated the Pandava brothers on that count. But also, Duryodhana and his 99 Kaurava brothers were, frankly, just plain nasty. For instance, the Pandavas were excellent students and made the Kauravas feel inferior. Their martial arts guru, Drona, tested all of the boys by mounting a wooden eagle on a tall pole and telling them to pierce the eye of the eagle. "What do you see?" he asked Arjuna. And he asked first each of the Kauravas, and they said, "I see you, I see the tree, I see the pole, and I see the eagle." And none of these answers pleased the great martial arts teacher Drona. And then he asked Arjuna, and Arjuna said, "I see only the head of the eagle and nothing else." "Really," said his teacher, "which part of the head?" "I see only the eye." Well, naturally, Arjuna was Drona's prize student, and as they grew, the Kauravas turned even more bitter, and they started to plot to kill the Pandava brothers. Their plan was to send the Pandavas on a vacation to this beautiful palace and have them killed by making it look like an accident. So the Pandavas' uncle Vidura, who is not in the Peter Brooks version of the story, by the way, gets wind of this plot and tells them to beware. He says the Kauravas plan to set the palace on fire at night. So here's what Vidura does to help his nephews and their mother. He sends an excavation expert to build a tunnel under the palace. The expert arrives and works under cover of darkness, and when the fire does get started, they escape to freedom and go to live in hiding in the forest. Now, in hiding, they have to beg for alms. It's the only way they can live. And every day they bring everything back to their mother, Kunti, who divides everything equally among the five brothers. And at that time, the brothers learn that there's a ceremony going on in which the princess Draupadi will choose her husband. Now, a royal daughter in those days was allowed to choose her own husband, but usually there was a qualifying tournament. And in this case, the various suitors had to string a magical bow that weighed so many tons that no one could lift it, and then shoot 5 arrows at a moving target, but only by looking at the reflection of the moving target in a pan of oil. All right. Now, obviously, many tried, couldn't even lift the bow. Arjuna stands up. Not only does he lift the bow and string it with ease, but he hits the target again and again and again. And Draupadi is, of course, enamored of this handsome and heroic young man, so she slips the victory garland around his neck, and off they go to meet Arjuna's mother, Kunti. Well, Arjuna and his brothers return home with Draupadi, and Bhima yells out from the doorway, "Mother, come see what a wonderful treasure we've brought home today." Kunti, as she did every day when her sons returned from begging alms in town, yells back, "Okay, whatever it is, share it with your brothers." Now, in this culture, a mother's wish is never to be disobeyed. It was simply not done. It was considered against Dharma. So after a lot of discussion about what is Dharma and what should we do, what is righteous action, Draupadi agrees that she will be the wife of all five Pandava brothers. Now, here's the thing about the Mahabharata. There's always a backstory. Okay? We talked about that. The backstory here is that Draupadi, in her previous life, had been married to a man who contracted leprosy. And as a result, became not only deformed, but also very depressed. Draupadi stood by him and cared for him without ever complaining. And predictably, as happens in such tales, the leprous husband one day says, "You're the best partner any man could ever want. Please know that I am neither diseased nor a bad person. I'm a god, and I was testing you for a great role you are to play in the future." I tried that line on a girl in college once, and it failed miserably. So now the husband says to Draupadi in her previous life, "You may ask of me anything you wish." And Draupadi says, "Well, you've only been to me 1/5 of what a husband should be. So I want to be loved as though I had 5 husbands." Okay, you're kind of following along with the logic here? All right, and sure enough, in her next life, she gets to marry all 5 of these righteous Pandava princes. So the moral is, well, one, be careful what you wish for, especially in front of gods disguised as leprous husbands. The arrangement was, here's how this worked out. It's very complicated. But the arrangement was that she would live with one brother at a time for 1 full year. And during that time, the other brothers would not think of her in any inappropriate way. And they made a life. Okay, meanwhile, blind King Dhritarashtra is in a dilemma. He loves his sons, naturally, headed by this rascal Duryodhana, even though they've no hesitation, acting in abominable ways. But he also feels some obligation to his late brother, Pandu. So he learns that the Pandavas are survived the burning palace. So he invites them to return home with their bride. They arrive, and Dhritarashtra says, "I'm going to divide the kingdom. My sons will remain here in Hastinapur and have half the kingdom. I'm going to give you this other half of the kingdom for yourselves." Well, the other half was mostly desert, but the Pandavas are happy since at least they now have a place to call their own. Okay, so their cousin Krishna steps in. Krishna and the Pandavas are related by marriage. Arjuna was married to Krishna's sister. Right? Krishna steps in and sends a celestial architect, if you will, kind of the Frank Gehry of the spiritual world, and he builds this magnificent city. It's like, Vegas. It's a kingdom in the desert, but much, much more stylish. And they called it Indraprastha, after the god of heaven, Indra. Now, Arjuna, I mentioned, was married to Subhadra. They have a son named Abhimanyu, who will be killed in the battle to come. And his son, Parikit, would be the last of the dynasty, the last great Vedic king before the onset of the age that we are living in now, Kali Yuga. So there was this close bond of friendship and family ties between Krishna and Arjuna. And of course, Duryodhana is burning up with envy when he finds out about Indraprastha. You know, they've got their own kingdom now and the Pandavas' palace. So Duryodhana goes and he is overwhelmed with the marble halls and the floors that shine like mirrors, and he humiliates himself by mistaking a pool of water for a smooth marble floor, and he falls in the pool of water. Well, Draupadi sees this and makes the mistake of laughing at him. Well, that was enough to push Duryodhana over the edge. So he calls his gangster uncle. He had a gangster uncle named Sakuni, which means vulture in Sanskrit. And he says, "The success of the Pandavas is burning my soul. And now this wife of theirs laughs in my face." Sakuni says, "You leave it to me. Just invite them to a game of dice. Invite them to play a game. And I'll play on your behalf, and you leave the rest to me." Now, meanwhile, back at Indraprastha, Yudhishthira, the eldest Pandava, And the one who should be crowned king is visited by Vyasa. Now, Vyasadeva, or Vyasa, is credited with being an incarnation of God. We spoke about him in one of our previous classes as the person credited with having taken the orally transmitted wisdom of the Vedas and codifying them in written form. The person who first made the Vedic text in written form. He has mystic powers befitting an incarnation. And so he looks into the future and he tells Yudhishthira the next 13 years will be very painful for you and your family. At the end of those 13 years, you must know that there will be an event, which we sitting here know will be the Mahabharata war, that will wipe out the world as you know it. And you will be the instrument of that destruction. Well, you know, Yudhishthira thinks this isn't too great. And he says to Vyasa, nothing can be done to change destiny, but here is my vow. From this day, I will not utter one harsh word to anyone. I will offend no one. Maybe this will somewhat mitigate the disaster that you have predicted. So it is just then that the invitation to play dice comes from their sworn enemies, the Kauravas. Now, Yudhishthira senses that there's something wrong here, there's something amiss, but he's taking this vow that he will not offend anyone. And it is against the warrior code anyway to refuse such an invitation. So he accepts the gambling challenge. So all five Pandavas and their wife Draupadi go to Hastinapur, the capital of the Kauravas, and they enter this magnificent crystal palace that Duryodhana has built, obviously to try to outdo the Pandavas in their palace and in their process. The main hall is filled with hundreds and thousands of guests, and the game of dice begins. And Sakuni, predictably, is unbeatable. He wins every throw of the dice, which were naturally tricked. But Yudhishthira is unable to decline to continue the game again and again. And little by little, he gambles away everything that the Pandavas possess. Their royal treasury, their kingdom in Indraprastha, their army, their clothes, their royal garments, and on and on and on. So the game continues. And next, Yudhishthira begins to gamble away his own family. With each toss of the fixed dice, he loses another one of his brothers. Then Duryodhana outdoes himself in outrageous behavior by proposing that Yudhishthira wager their wife Draupadi. Now the whole assembly moans in shame at this outrage. But Yudhishthira is in a kind of stupor. He can't stop himself at this point. And he agrees to wager Draupadi. And he loses. Now Duryodhana had this younger brother who was a real jerk named Dushasana. Dushasana goes to Draupadi's quarters and tells her, and she can't believe her ears, and she simply refuses to go, and saying, not only will she not agree to such folly, but she is not even properly dressed. Only one piece of cloth covering her. But Dushasana drags her into the assembly hall, and she is presented before the assembly. She stands there in the middle of these ferocious warriors. Her husband sits and does nothing. All the brothers do nothing. They hang their heads in shame. Draupadi offers a brilliant rebuttal, by the way, of having been sold down the river, noting that the other side never matched Yudhishthira's wager. That was one thing. Very, very intelligent, if you will, argument against this horrendous situation. There was never a counter proposal. The other side, her husband was forced into the game. He was never asked to play. He was forced into it because obliged by Kshatriya code. The whole thing is rigged, obviously. And hearing all of this, Vikarna, who's one of the 100 Kaurava brothers, agrees with her. And he said, Yudhishthira never had the right to wager her. And I won't put up with what my eldest brother has done. She has not been won fairly. And people break out in applause. So even some of the Kauravas and the, you know, aristos in the audience see this as a farce. But Duryodhana is a slave to his anger, to the Pandavas. And he tells his younger brother, to disrobe Draupadi. What happens next is one of the most celebrated events in all of Indian culture, all of Indian history. Dushasana grabs her sari and starts pulling. At first, he tries to hold on to her clothing. Right? Well, what can she do against this powerful warrior? She throws up her arms finally and prays, "Krishna, Krishna, I put myself in your hands." And she's so completely absorbed in thoughts of God, of Krishna, with her eyes shut, deep in meditation. And Dushasana's pulling the sari and pulling the sari, and Krishna incarnates as an infinite length of cloth. So Dushasana's pulling and pulling and pulling, but it never ends. And hours later, there's this huge pile of cloth in the middle of the assembly, and Draupadi is still dressed. She's still covered. And everyone is moved by this miracle, including the blind king Dhritarashtra, who says to her, "Dear lady, clearly you are protected by God. You may ask any favor you want." So immediately she says, "I want you to free my husbands from this accursed game." And the king agrees, and the Pandavas return with Draupadi to their capital city in Draprastha. Now Duryodhana cannot bear this humiliation, and he sends a messenger saying that the Pandavas are invited back for a rematch. No, Yudhisthira again remembers the prediction of Vyasadeva and said, "This is God's will. So they return, and Shakuni announces, "This time the stakes will be different. Whoever loses this time must go into exile for 12 years. Then they must remain incognito for another year. And if they're discovered during that 13th year, then they must go back into exile for another 12 years. Well, naturally, the predictable happens. Shakuni wins. The Pandavas shed their royal robes, put on the cloth of mendicants, and head out for their exile. So, in exile, the Pandavas face one disaster after another. Kunti elaborates their suffering to Krishna, and sometimes it seems that we may take yoga classes because we seek relief from the suffering, the frustrations of the material world. Kunti had a somewhat different take on it. She says to Krishna, "You bring it on. You keep us in this kind of a condition. The more challenges life throws my way, the more I'm forced to remember you. So you bring it on. Whatever fate will have in store for me, I don't care, because it's an impetus for me to always be thinking about you in love." So during these 12 years, they have numerous adventures. No time to tell you all of them. Here's one adventure that they were looking for food, and Bhima, remember, Bhima is like this big hulk of a guy, voracious appetite. This village sends food out to a demon in the woods. So Bhima says, I'll drive that wagon. I'm seeing all the food in the back. So he starts eating it all. The demon comes, and Bhima's fighting him off with one hand and eating the food with the other hand. Like, there's all kinds of stories within stories within stories. And here's a picture of Queen Kunti in that mood of Krishna. Just keep me in this situation. Keep me always thinking of you. At one point, Draupadi confronts Yudhisthira. Okay. And she says, "How could you allow this to happen? You're Mr. Mellow, you know. You're just like always so calm. And you never get angry, even when you should. Those monsters did not deserve your respect and obedience." And Yudhisthira says, "Anger is never the solution to anything. Anger is the root of all destruction. And there can be no limit to forgiveness and tolerance and faith in God's wisdom and justice." Draupadi disagrees. She says, "Your inappropriate tolerance is what made this calamity happen. You would sooner lose your family than break your fanatical ideals. Frankly, right now, I don't think too highly of God or his wisdom and justice." And Yudhisthira is shocked. He says, you're talking like an atheist. And she says, "No, not an atheist, a realist. Those who believe in destiny and those who don't are equally foolish. The only worthwhile path is to act and do what is right." So, you know, there are nuances of philosophy. Don't think that, you know, Bhagavad Gita and, you know, the Krishna way is some kind of blind religious faith. There's a lot of very, very careful weighing of moral and ethical issues in the balance. Of course,
the Pandavas in exile. They managed these 12 years, and you can buy the action figures
to go with the story, probably on Amazon. So then they have to remain in hiding, and they're unrecognized for another year, and they decide to seek work during that year in a nearby kingdom ruled by a king named Virata. And Yudhisthira says he will present himself. They have to hide somewhere. So Yudhisthira says, okay, I'm going to be a companion to the king, and I'll, you know, gamble and play games with him. Okay. Bhima says, I'm going to work in the kitchen. I'll disguise myself as a chef, naturally, and do some feats of strength to entertain the royal family. Arjuna says he will wear a long braid and a dress like a woman and teach dance and music to the women of the palace, which puts Bhima into a fit of hysterics. I mean, you know, imagine a big, strong warrior like Arjuna as a dance instructor. Think, you know, Russell Crowe in drag. And Draupadi says she will be a lady-in-waiting for the queen. Now, before they leave the forest, Arjuna ties their weapons in a sack and secures the sack in a tree, and off they go for a year in hiding. Just a few days before the end of that year in hiding, the Kauravas hear rumors of where they are. The bad guys say, oh, that's where the Pandavas are hiding. And they prepare to attack Virata's kingdom. King Virata had a son named Prince Uttara, another real idiot, a real space cadet, and a braggart to boot. And when he hears that the Kauravas are attacking, he makes this big show of putting on armor. He's going to fight them off. All I need is a good chariot driver, because, you know, there's no chariot drivers in the whole kingdom. All I need is a good chariot, and I'll fight them, and blah, blah, blah. So Arjuna sees this as a chance to finally settle the score with Duryodhana, so he volunteers, right? So he's going at this point by the name of Brihanala, and as soon as they approach the Kaurava army, they see that the Kaurava, it's huge. And Uttara is thinking, hey, you know what, Brihanala, slow down a minute, we should think this through. I didn't expect it was going to be such a big army, let's talk about it. Now, Arjuna just keeps driving the chariot closer and closer to the enemy army. Uttara's going, Brihanala, do you hear me? Look, I'm not going. I can't fight this. Go back. I have some medicine. I'm just going to... This is exactly what happens to Arjuna a few days before the battle of Kurukshetra. That same sense of doubt, self... the loss of self-confidence. And so Arjuna has this reference, right? Interesting point of reference behind him, identifying with what he had known previously to that moment on the battlefield. They go to the tree. Arjuna drives the chariot to the tree, brings down the weapons, starts to put on his armor. And Uttara is looking at this transformation going on of his sister's dance instructor, and he can't take it. And he says, finally, who the hell are you? You know? And Arjuna says, I'm Arjuna. And Uttara cries out, let us off to battle! And, you know, of course, got Arjuna, he won't have to do anything. Well, Arjuna uses a mystic weapon to put the entire Kaurava army to sleep. And he steals their armor and weapons and leaves them naked the way they wanted to leave his wife, Draupadi. Now, Krishna acts at this moment like a mediator. Right? They wake up and they're furious and they're ready to do battle. And Krishna goes to them and says, if you return the Pandavas' kingdom to them, this war can be avoided. Now, of course, the Kauravas refuse. And there is one final attempt at resolving their dispute without bloodshed. Forget half the kingdom, Krishna says, negotiating. He says, give the Pandavas one village each to rule. That's all, just one village each. As warriors, they have to have something to administer. Duryodhana is inflexible. He says, Krishna, you're biased. You're related by marriage. You're biased in favor of the Pandavas. I won't even grant them enough land in which to drive the head of a pin. So Krishna goes even further at this point, and as a final gesture of attempting to reconcile and convince the Kauravas to give up this plan of battle, he reveals his universal form, as he does one more time on the battlefield for Arjuna, and says, I'm God, and I'm telling you to make peace. Right? And they still refuse. And at this point, of course, war is inevitable. And there you have it, a summary of 100,000 verses in 18 minutes. Right. So there's one postscript that I do want to tell you about, however. After the battle is fought and won, and the Pandavas rule for a certain number of years, and the time comes
for them to give up their material life and prepare to die. They head up to the Himalayan mountains, which is the way of the Vedic kings. And there is a well. The rumor is that there's a well somewhere halfway up the Himalayas with a bottomless pit. And that is where kings would shed their armor and drop it into that well as a way of divesting themselves of their material past and attachments and prepare to die. So one by one, the Pandava princes shed their armor and die. And only Yudhishthira is left. Now, there's a dog who had been following them throughout their many adventures over these many years. And the dog is a faithful friend. And Yudhishthira reaches the gates of Vaikuntha, of the spiritual world, and a voice calls out at that point and says, "You may enter, but not the dog." And at this point, Yudhishthira says, "After all we've been through, after all the betrayals that we've had to endure, this one small, humble creature is the only one who's been faithful to us. If there's no room for him in heaven, then there's no room for me." And he turns to walk away. And at that moment, the dog reveals himself to be Yamaraj, the Lord of Dharma, Yudhishthira's father, and says, "This was my final test for you." And he and his brothers are all then allowed into the eternal spiritual realm. So, now, I hope that this works well. I'm going to try to run this clip for you. This is the first clip that we're going to see is that scene of the disrobing of Draupadi. It's a key moment. In this scene, you'll see blind King Dhritarashtra. You'll see his wife Gandhari with the blindfold over her eyes. You'll see the maliciousness of his sons led by Duryodhana. And I want you to just note down, even if it's just mentally, things in this, about 20 minutes, I think, this clip that I think you'll enjoy. Things that appeal to you as important for some reason, and then afterwards we'll discuss that. Okay? All right, let's see how well we've learned our technology here. Okay. All right, this should begin now. Okay, here we go. All right, where's the sound? I had sound here a moment ago. Let's see. What's going on? All right, well, let's see what we can do. Okay.
No, I am like dried up stream, like a wooden elephant, all because my father was born blind, because one does not give a throne to a blind man.
Calm yourself. Send for your wives.
But I want to be discontented, dissatisfied. A man's body grows from birth, and everyone is delighted in the same way. His desire grows. His desire for power. I have doubts about myself. Sometimes I even question my value. I must resolve these doubts.
You have a shadow in your mind. It sweeps you away with incredible force.
Why?
Why refuse a simple game of dice? The gods created the world as a game. Insects play with flowers. The stars dance their secret patterns in the sky. Why, Dritarashtra, must you always frown on pleasure?
A game of dice is being prepared.
I know. What do you want?
Bhishma, here your authority is not disputed. If I come like a shadow to speak with you, it is to ask a favor. Whatever you see in the course of the game, whatever you hear, you must not interrupt the match.
In no circumstances.
In no circumstances.
Wouldn't it be better to avoid the worst?
What is the worst?
Destruction.
Destruction of what?
Of the way of truth. Of the order of the world.
Destruction of Dharma. That is the worst.
And if your race had to be destroyed so as to save Dharma, would you be prepared to sacrifice your race? What is your answer?
That question is with me always, sharpening my thoughts, destroying my sleep, making my heart pound all night long.
That is why I ask you, do not intervene. Let each one go to his limit.
It's you who are going to play?
Yes. I'll play for my nephew.
You spend your life playing. People have seen you perform unbelievable tricks. But cheating is a crime.
The powerful player who knows how to play and who ponders calmly is not worried by cheating. Here, there is no crime. Only the game. Nothing but the game. A seasoned warrior fights against beginners. You call that cheating? Science is not cheating. You always enter a game with a wish to win. That's how life is. No cheat can ever defeat a master. Withdraw from the match if you are afraid.
You know I cannot refuse to play once I'm challenged. I have a gold necklace and pearls without equal, churned in the vortex of the ocean. I play them against you.
I have won.
I have gold and jewels locked in 400 coffers.
I have gold and jewels. That's not what I want.
I have 100,000 female slaves. Young, beautiful, trained in 64 skills. Swift-fingered Shakuni, I have as many male slaves. Obedient, adroit, dressed in the finest silk.
I have one.
I have 16,000 chariots with golden shafts.
I have one.
My cows, my bulls, my goats, my elephants.
I have one.
My forests.
I have one.
My capital.
I have one.
My lands.
I have one.
My kingdom. All that I possess.
Bhishma, stop the match. You say nothing.
Yudhishthira, do you wish to stop the game?
No. Let's proceed.
I won everything. Have you still something left?
Have my brothers Nakula and Sahadeva, the twins with golden eyes, sons of Madri. They are beyond all value. I play them against you.
I have won. Madri's sons are ours.
Bahachal.
I still have Arjuna. He who can never lose. Krishna's friend. When he plucks the cord of his bow Gandiva, every living creature trembles. He's as precious to me as life. I now play him against you. I still have Bhima, built like a lion, the mightiest of men. He is strength itself. I play him against you.
I have won.
Vacha!
Have you still something left?
Of all my brothers, I remain alone. I stake myself. Yudhishthira. I play myself.
Worse than to lose oneself. For when one loses everything, freedom is the only wealth that remains. But you have one last possession, and you forget it.
What?
You possess a wife. She's the only treasure I have not won. Stake Draupadi and win back everything, thanks to her.
She's a woman who is neither too short nor too tall. Neither pale nor dark. She's the Earth's most perfect creation. And the pole of all men's desire. I play her against you.
Draupadi.
What do you want?
You are requested to come to the palace.
Who requests me? Why?
Because Yudhishthira has lost you.
What do you mean he has lost me?
He has lost you at dice.
Had he nothing else to play?
He played all he had and lost it all. He even played and lost himself.
Lost himself?
That's what I say.
Before losing me? Or after?
Before losing you.
Return to the hall and ask him this. Is it true that you lost yourself first before losing me? And if you yourself were lost, had you the right to play me?
You were staked and lost. You are ours. Come.
Allow me to dress. I have only one robe and it is stained in blood. I'm in my period. Don't show me in this state to the kings.
Who cares? We have won. You are dice. You are now no more than a slave. Enough. Come.
Here is the new servant.
There is not a breath of life in Bhishma and Drona. They see this shame and they do nothing.
Yudhishthira, did you have the right to lose me? If you lost yourself first before playing me, I was no longer yours. Can one belong to someone who has lost himself?
Bhishma, answer me.
I am troubled. The question is obscure.
When Yudhishthira made this wager, he had already lost himself. So he could not play his wife.
Error. She was designated by name and well and truly won.
Apathy satisfies five men. She's clearly public property.
Whether he lost her before or after, I don't see the difference. Draupadi has been won. I regret to have to say it, but it is so.
Everything has been won. Their clothes, down to the last clasp.
Draupadi as well. We want to see her naked.
Dushasana, take off her robe.
Listen to what I say. When the battle comes, I will smash Dushasana's chest. And I'll drink his blood, I swear I will. I will eat his guts and drink his blood. Now bellow.
You only frighten the flies.
Prapanna Pahi Govinda Kuru Madhye Vasidate.
Krishna.
Watch. The miracle is taking place under our eyes.
It's a prodigy of Krishna.
A prodigy? Where do you see a prodigy? He's wearing layers and layers of cloth.
Put her with the slaves to scrape the dishes.
Let me go. Where is Dharma? I see nothing clearly.
Draupadi, your new masters are here. Choose a new husband.
Karna!
Can you hold your tongue? You don't own yourself anymore. You haven't even the right to be angry.
Draupadi, you want another man. Look at my thigh.
Well done, isn't it? It's really got a lot going on there. Okay, so you can see why this production was so well heralded, you know, and the film received an Emmy Award and all kinds of accolades like that. What did you find significant in here? What struck you? Anything in particular that you thought lent some insight into what we've been discussing for the last few weeks in terms of the Bhagavad Gita contextualized by this much larger story? For example, one of the anomalies of the Gita is that it ends in battle. And people often ask, well, how could Krishna sanction battle? We see this and we get a better sense, don't we, of what some of the backstory is here and how battle became unavoidable. The Kauravas were absolutely not going to be
placated or pacified or in any way, shape, or form dissuaded from the course they had set upon, which was basically to wipe out the Pandavas. So that's clear. That's come clear. What about Yudhishthira? He's a real anomaly in this, isn't he? Right? Is he addicted? Is he obsessed? What's his story? I mean, why, you know... Okay, fine, you know, you're not supposed to refuse a wager, you know, if you're a Vedic king. But really? I mean, you know...
But he also avoids confrontation. He's that person. He's made this vow to avoid confrontation.
Okay, very good. Very good. There's a personality at work here. You know, not just principles. And one of the things that we see by participating in an enactment like this, which is really masterfully done, is that the personalities of these characters begin to emerge. They're not just some mythological collection of beings. They're living, breathing people, and they have personalities, and they have backstories, and they have psyches, and things that stop them from doing certain things, that compel them to behave in a particular way. So yes, either the Gita and the whole theology of Krishna consciousness is some religious construct to just put some wisdom teachings out into the world, in which case you don't have to concern yourself with the psychology of the characters. It's all a myth. Or you allow room for the possibility that this is real. And if it's real, then you've got to go deeper inside what's being said, what those teachings are, what the context of the story, the housing is all about. And it begins to make sense, because now we have some role to play here. Now we have something that we can begin to identify with. As long as this is all about mythology and creatures and characters from some other world, it doesn't really affect us. As soon as they become real, human, and all of a sudden we begin to see, wow, something in that resonates with me. Like Yudhishthira, for example, I have to say frankly, you know, I've always been a bit of a wuss. You know, I'm not very good with confrontation. Not good at all. And in Yudhishthira, I see a quality. He just wants to be a good guy. He wants to do the right thing, you know? And sometimes the way this world is put together, you can't always be a good guy.
It's an attachment.
It's an attachment to be good, like to want to be good. Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Like the Narada, well, Narada was attached to goodness, right?
Mm-hmm. Who was?
Narada. I'm listening to where I'm on Dani Dari's
song. Oh, Narada. Narada Muni?
About Narada, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's in the Bhagavad Gita, that there's a quality to goodness that you become somewhat preoccupied with your own sense of being a good person. That's why goodness is not spiritual. It may be a more refined level of material character. It's not in and of itself spiritual. Spiritual sometimes may look like something that is materially reprehensible, like having to fight a battle. So you can't judge it by those externals. Yeah?
When I walked in, I think you were discussing how Yudhishthira was hearing from Vyas about the future. So is that another reason he was compelled to allow this all to happen? And if so, why? Just because you see some future as that may happen, if it's an ugly future, why...
Well, what I think you missed it because you came in just a little bit too late. But Yudhishthira said when Vyasa gave him this prophecy of things to come, and he said, "You're going to be the cause of this." He says, "Okay, I'm not going to offend anyone ever again. At least, maybe I can't avoid this calamity, but I can attenuate it. I can maybe minimize it by being the very best person I possibly can."
Which is what causes.
Exactly.
But that's his fatal flaw, that decision.
Right. That's right.
So he won't stand up for his principles.
Which says what? Which says what about how we perceive what it means to be a spiritual person or a really good... What does it say about that? It says, if nothing else, be careful about your own judgment of such things. We live today with an image of what a holy person is, which is rather naive. You know, we have an image of someone who's basically the opposite of a bad person. And so we have arbitrary character definitions and traits. So that when we see something happening, I'm writing a biography of our teacher, Prabhupada, right now. And there was a moment in 1966, June of 66, very small, there was no International Krishna Society at that time. It was a handful of people coming to 26 Second Avenue, two blocks away, for classes Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And at one morning session, one of the early students was prattling on about how, well, it's not really Krishna speaking the Bhagavad Gita, is it? You know, it's some impersonal truth that speaks through Krishna, and it's, you know, the eternal divine energy, and Krishna is just a mouthpiece for that higher wisdom. And Prabhupada's face was getting redder and redder. And finally he says, are you through yet? And this student said, no. And it goes on and on and on. Prabhupada's face is getting redder and redder. And finally he says, now are you through? And this young man said, yes. Prabhupada says quite calmly, he says, have you understood what we've been discussing about Krishna being the absolute truth? He says, yes. Prabhupada stood up, because he would sit on a pillow on the floor. He stood up to full height and took his hand and slammed it down on the table. And the room shook from it. And he said, then why do you want to take it away from Krishna? It is not something speaking through Krishna. It is Krishna. It is Krishna. And he was yelling this. He was strong. And everyone was like backing up to the corners of the room. And they had never seen a holy person, you know, roaring like a lion. As far as they were concerned, you know, where's the shanti, man? You know, where's the peace and the, you know, and the mellowness and all of that stuff? And it impressed upon them not only Prabhupada's character, but what he was about to unleash on the Western world, which was a vastly new definition of what it means to be holy. You no longer have to go along, you know, twiddling flowers and being peaceful. You can roar like a lion and roll like a truck. When you're working on behalf of Krishna and you see how aggressively people are being kept in their ignorance, sometimes that needs to be met with strength. Not shanti, but with strength. So we're... those are the kinds of things that... Now imagine, you've got 100,000 verses in this story. So it can go on for months, the telling and the discussing of it. So we will continue next week with part two of the Mahabharata. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.